Okay, we want to introduce to you, in case you're one of the people who don't know about Mike Dowling, born and raised in Knockaderry in County Limerick. I want to again welcome Mike Dowling. Good man, friend. Okay.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you, Adrian.
Tell me, Mike, now that we have the first anniversary this week of the official announcement of the pandemic, which initially became, we'd have to say, a political football. We heard from the highest levels of the White House saying, don't worry about this, is going to go away. You know, when the summer picks up, when the heat picks up, it will disappear. And that was somewhat in contrast to what you were saying and your initial analysis of COVID-19 and its beginning. And a lot of people didn't in the political arena said, no, don't listen to him. Tell us. If you will, you might start with saying the recognition of something that very few healthcare systems knew anything about, were not prepared for.
Right. Well, first of all, you know, pandemics don't just come and go quickly. And the history of pandemics is that they come and they last a long time. And the pandemic we knew back in January. I recognized and my staff recognized that it was in all likelihood going to hit New York. This was January of 2020 because we had been watching what was going on in Italy and in Wuhan in China. And it arrived in New York at the end of February. And in the first case that hit our health system, Northwell, was March 2nd of 2020. And by the beginning of April, we had on a daily basis 3,500 COVID patients in our hospitals. I don't think there has been anybody in the United States that has had as many COVID patients as us. Since it began over a year ago, we have treated almost 190,000 COVID patients. This is serious business. And I believe that the politics, of course, was pretty crazy, as you mentioned at that time. When you're dealing with a situation like this, you have to focus on the facts. You have to focus on science. And you can't politicize it away. It is here. And right now, after a year of dealing with this, we're in a relatively good position in New York right now. The numbers are decreasing. As of today, I have a little over 800 patients in my hospitals. And that's a good sign. And the positivity rate in the region is coming down. But I would just caution everybody that despite the fact that it looks like it's getting better, we still have to wear the masks. We still should social distance when appropriate, wash the hands, etc. Because these things have the ability to bounce back again. Although if I were to make a prediction, I would say that you know, by the middle of the summer, end of the summer, we should be in relatively good shape and that we will be getting back to some kind of normality. But this has been a pretty unique, extraordinary year. And I have to give credit to the healthcare employees, the frontline employees, nurses, physicians, and others. They did absolutely extraordinary work. We are learning from this. We will learn from this. And it has changed our perspectives, I believe. And I think at the end of the day, despite how difficult it was, that in many ways we will be better off for it because it demonstrates our fragility. It demonstrates that we have always got to be prepared for that which is going to be very uncomfortable and that bad things sometimes happen and we just have to deal with it. So my hat's off to all of the people on the front lines who did extraordinary work here. And one last comment, Adrian. While the virus itself will recede into the background, although it will still be around because we will be taking probably a booster shot every year from now on because of the virus, and the vaccination process is moving along. But the economic dislocation resulting from COVID will go on for years. Many, many businesses will never come back the way they were before. Some businesses are closed forever. So there's going to be an economic tail to this, which will not be good for many, many years. So we have to be patient, consistent, and resilient to be able to overcome this in the long run.
Mike Dowling, I wanted to ask you about, a couple of thorny issues. Some of them are personified by the reluctance of many people who, particularly in the disadvantaged communities, the marginalized, of people who say, I don't trust it. I'm going to wait, I'll wait for a bit and see what happens. This herd immunity, that should be coming through any time. What's the danger for those, how do you get through to them to say?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of reasons why people, there are some elements of the population that are hesitant about vaccines. There's a couple of reasons for this. One is in the black community, for example, there has been very inappropriate research done with vaccines in the past. And so that kind of history lingers, and there is that kind of worry about it. That's a small group, I believe. Others, some people don't trust the vaccines themselves, this vaccine, because they think it was developed very, very quickly. And if something was done this quickly, then it cannot have been done correctly. That's completely inappropriate. It was done correctly. The science is great. The science is the best we've actually seen in a long time. And the proper precautions were taken in developing the vaccine. So I would not be fearful at all on that issue. Some people then don't trust big organizations. Some people don't trust the government, etc. But I do believe that that as time goes on, more and more people will get the vaccine. We are now at Northwell. We now have the ability to vaccinate up to 100,000 people a week. The problem up to this point has been that there has been a shortage of supply. We've not been able to do an awful lot because the availability of the vaccine wasn't there. And then the vaccines up to this point have been two doses. You have to get it twice. That gets very, very complicated. And some hesitancy by some people is the wait around wondering what the effect is going to be of the people that have already taken the vaccine. And the results so far are absolutely unbelievable. We haven't seen anybody in over 50 million people getting the vaccine, and we haven't seen any death resulting from the vaccine. We've seen a lot of death resulting from COVID, of course, as you know. So I think now with the new vaccine, the Johnson & Johnson, where it is one dose, which is much more easier to implement, and the availability of that supply will increase dramatically in the next 2 to 3 weeks. So I think that when we get to the end of the spring, that we will be getting closer to having herd immunity, definitely by the middle of the summer, I believe. When you add the number of people that will have got the vaccine and the number of people that have already got COVID, which means that they have already some antibodies. And one other thing to keep in mind here and put in perspective, even with the flu shot, we still get 20 to 25% of people, like up to 30% of the people who refuse to take the flu shot. So if you get to 70% of the people who get it, the vaccine, or have some antibodies, that's as good as you can probably get. You'd like 100%, but it's not going to happen. Even in my own employees, I've never been able to get more than 85, 86% of the people who work for me to take the flu shot. Because you do have a lot of anti-vaxxers out there. So, but overall, it's a good story. We're in a good place. The vaccine works. People should take it. You should not be fearful of it. You should not be hesitant. Go get vaccinated. I can tell you from being in the hospitals every day around people that are dying from COVID, if you were in those circumstances and you saw that, then you will go take the vaccine. Any side effect from the vaccine, which is absolutely minimal, pales in comparison to the results of getting COVID itself.
Michael Dowling, we are getting some emails here, questions from people right across the United States saying, well, then should we wait for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to come on board rather than, be sweating it out with the Pfizer 3 weeks, with Moderna 4 weeks. So now should, what's the danger, or should we?
I would basically say to people, you have a chance to get the vaccine, get it. And just get the vaccine, the one that's available. Johnson & Johnson is available today. We're using Johnson & Johnson today. So I would say to people, you have an opportunity to get the vaccine, go get the vaccine. If you have to come back for a second shot, you come back for a second shot. It's not that difficult. The one-shot J&J works. The two-shot Pfizer works. The two-shot Moderna works. So whichever is available in your community, and you get contacted to get vaccinated, don't sit there and say, oh, let me wait until later. Just go get vaccinated. You're doing your family a favor, your friends a favor, and, of course, yourself a favor. Protect yourself from getting COVID so that we can get back to normality as quickly as possible. So I would say just go get vaccinated.
What about those who say, well, how do I know that in 3 weeks or in 4 weeks that I'll actually be able to get it? And does it have to be, exactly 3 weeks, Pfizer, 4 weeks?
If you take Pfizer, there is a couple of days of cushion. So it's 21 days with Pfizer. But, if you come back on the 23rd, the 24th day, that is fine. I think within 4 or 5 days of the date that they give you. If you get the first vaccine, the second one will be available for you. I wouldn't worry about that at all. We've already done 210,000 vaccinations in my organization already. And there are a small handful of people who do not come back for the second dose. And we're trying to track those down, trying to understand why. But it's a very, very, very small percentage.
Okay.
So if you get a Pfizer or Moderna that requires two doses and you get the first one, come back for the second one, it will be available.
All right. That indeed answers a couple of the emails that are here saying, is it the time we got the first one, time has passed? Is there... let me just see on you. Okay. It's, could we skip the second one?
I would recommend that you do not do that. Now, you do get some immunity from the first one. So the first one does it give you some protection. But if you want to be fail-safe and sure, what's the reason not to get the second one? The second one actually gives you further protection. And so I don't, there should be no reason why you shouldn't want to get the second one. Why take half the course of medicine? Why not take the whole thing? So I would say to them, and I would urge them, go get both. It takes 15, 20 minutes out of your time, out of your day to do it. And if you are worried about yourself, just think of your family. By doing this, you're protecting your family, you're protecting your friends, you're protecting your neighborhood. And it sets you free to be able to do things in normal circumstances that now you might be a little bit resistant to do. But I would also say, though, that when you get the vaccine and you're in a large group of people, in the public, I'd still wear a mask. I mean, you don't need to wear a mask if you're with a small group of people that have all have been vaccinated. Then it is possible, and it is, the CDC said it is okay to take your mask off. But for a period of time, wear the mask. Why not? It's not that inconvenient. We're getting used to it. If we want to beat the virus and beat the pandemic, let's just comply. And at the end of the day, hopefully by the fall, we will be in a very good position if everybody just complies.
Now that we have vaccine either readily available, although we could use a lot more, can we skip the testing part? Obviously, great emphasis was saying get tested, make sure. And apparently a lot of people now are saying, well, I won't bother taking the test because I'll be getting the vaccine, you know, fairly soon.
Oh, I would. I would get tested. I mean, to give you an example, I went to a hockey game this past weekend. Not this past weekend, just 3 nights ago, because some of the arenas are opening up, and we were doing a sponsorship with one of the local teams. And I have received a vaccine, and I got Pfizer. But everybody that went to that arena had to get tested just to make sure that there was nobody that was in any way carrying the virus and would be in danger. So I just got tested. I got the quick test. It takes 15 minutes. And even though I had the vaccine, I already got tested. So I would still continue to get tested when people require you to do so. For example, if you fly on an airplane right now, you'll have to get tested beforehand. If you go into large arenas as they open up, there will probably be a requirement to get tested. So until all of this works its way through over the next couple of months, I would say if some people ask you to get tested, get tested. If you have the opportunity to get the vaccine. Why not? It's all part of the process of being able to get rid of this thing once and for all.
You have now a bestseller book leading through the pandemic. But actually, before we get to that, I'd like to ask you about the first book, After the Roof Caved In. It's an immigrant's journey from Ireland to America. And that brings us back to your growing up, being born and raised in County Limerick in Ireland, Knockaderry. By the way, where is Knockaderry?
Knockaderry is on West Limerick. For people listening, the biggest town near it is Newcastle West. Knockaderry is about 5 miles from Newcastle West. It's a very small village. It has, as Irish people will know, very typical. It has a church. It has the local pub. It has a post office, and it has a couple of other buildings that people live in. And I grew up walking distance from that village in a farming area, very picturesque, very beautiful. We did not have a farm. We were, one of the poorest families in the community. And I grew up in a thatched house with, the mud walls, etc., no electricity, running water, bathrooms. And that's where I grew up in actually a very picturesque area of West Limerick, but a lot of poverty, but very picturesque.
Now, you say you didn't have a farm. So how did you make a living there? Because your father died rather...
My father was a laborer. He worked in the county council. I was the oldest of 5 kids, and my father did suffer terribly from arthritis. He became pretty well crippled with arthritis at the age of 42, so he wasn't able to work much after that at all. And obviously you get some government support. And one of the reasons for me leaving Knockaderry, and I went to England to begin working in a steel factory south of London when I was 16, 17. I left because I dreamed about going to college, and I wanted to help my parents because things were pretty bad. And so I went to England. I worked there, came back. I was fortunate enough to do well in secondary school, or high school as we know it here, to qualify for college. I got into UCC, But I wasn't able to afford UCC unless I made my own money. So I came to the U.S., and I did that for for half the year for the first 3 years. So I would spend late spring, summer, and early fall in New York working, and then I would go back to college in Ireland in the winter. I did that for 3 years to UCC, Cork. And then after I graduated, I came back to the United States, and I worked down in the docks on the west side of Manhattan. I worked in construction, and I worked in plumbing, etc. And then, things happened. I took advantages of opportunities that came about. And my whole family is still in Ireland. I'm the only one of the family here in the United States. So it, for me, I wrote the book because I think there's elements of my book in everybody's immigrant history, but it's an immigrant story. History is important to me, and it was important to recount my journey, which is not terribly unique from a lot of other people's journey, but I thought it was important to tell it. In my view, as my mother would say, and she was absolutely a phenomenal woman, and the reason, in many ways, the primary reasons why I am who I am today. But she always argued, don't ever let your circumstance impede your future potential. Irrespective of how bad your background was, it doesn't in any way preclude you from being successful. So don't just play victim. Don't complain about what happened to you. Get up and move on, and be productive, and don't wallow in self-pity. Just get about the business, and with a combination of hard work and luck, you can make it.
Yeah. You have a reputation, indeed, of taking on, some never-tried-before, mountains to climb. And a lot of people say, okay, Dowling can't do this one. And that becomes a challenge to you. Is there motivation when, many times people have tried something, failed, and then you say there's got to be a way around this, or where?
Well, I think... life is a journey, and obstacles, are always in front of you. But as I often think, if there is a journey with no obstacles, you're probably not going anyplace. And be competitive. I'm pretty competitive. I look at opportunity, not challenges. Everything that's in front, I say, okay, that's a wonderful opportunity. Challenge you to think about how best you can take care of it, how best you can handle it, and be resilient, and be adaptable, and be flexible, and be tenacious. There is nothing that you can't do if you try hard enough. The worst thing is being afraid to take some risk. There's a great phrase by George Eliot, I think he said, if you don't take a lot of risk, then you're never sure where it is you can end up. You have to go after risk, and you've got to take it, try your best, and move on. So to me, I love challenge. I love competition. You may not always succeed. You can fail. But you learn from failure. Every person that's ever been in any way successful has failed multiple times. Every development in history has in part resulted from the lessons learned from failure. So I enjoy it. I love the journey. I love the challenge. And there's nothing wrong with failure, you don't lose when you fail, in my view. You lose when you quit. You don't quit.
Well, one of, excuse the expression, one of your peculiarities is that unlike most people and most CEOs and presidents of massive companies have the privilege of sitting in an ivory tower. And many employees know there's a figurehead there somewhere, but you would never see him out and about or whatever. You, 73,000 employees and growing, you have the reputation of not only, you know, showing up at every, you know, facility in time, but that you stroll in as if you were, you know, somebody who was just looking to see how something is done, rather than come in, you know, with a cane or a stick and say, listen, this is how I want this done.
Well, organizations are all about the people that you have. That's all an organization is. It's a collection and a collective of people. And you want the people working in the same direction, rowing in the same direction, having the same commitment and passion. And I meet every new employee that is hired because I think that's very, very important. I do that every single Monday. And we hire about between 150 and 200 a week. And obviously it's in a group settings, but I spend a couple of hours every Monday doing that. I walk the floors of the facilities all the time. I do not believe that a CEO should sit in the office and just issue orders. You need to get out onto the factory floor. You need to understand the world that people live in. You need to empathize with their circumstance. You need to understand their circumstance. You need to listen. You need to know what's going on. You improve people's performance by inspiration. You inspire performance. You don't dictate performance. You get people to want to belong to something. Most people, in my view, don't just want to work for an organization. They want to belong to an organization with a mission and a commitment. So you got to get people to understand what we're all about, especially in healthcare. So I actually love being out and about, understanding what the circumstances are. And then changing, you know, making modifications in your position if you find out that you're learning something that you didn't understand before. And it's about having a degree of humility. I mean, what is a CEO? CEO, you know, I get a title. That doesn't, a title does not bestow you power. Power comes from followership, from people committed to what it is you're claiming to be about. So I just love being out with employees. Every employee can reach me. I respond to every employee's letter or email. I talk to employees all the time because those are the people who do the work. I am lucky, and I've said this all the time, I am fortunate to be working with so many fabulous employees. And if I can inspire them to do the right thing for the community, as they have demonstrated clearly during COVID over the past 12 months, then I have done my job well. But I don't do my job by sitting in my office thinking I'm so important, walking around with an air of authority and, being in the C-suite, just wallowing in your own self-importance. That's not what gets organizations working. And so I just love being out and about with the employees.
Okay, well, you know, I have a granddaughter, Fallon, and Anya's niece, Patricia, and we asked them, you know, what's a memorable experience in the Northwell Health System? And both of them, most others would say, going in timidly into a new job and having the president, the CEO, you know, just talk to us and say, you're welcome. And then the motivation comes immediately after that. And you do tell them what a great opportunity, what, you know, how each person, you know, can learn themselves, because you have a great outfit and it works. And it makes them feel, you know, very special.
Yeah, well, it's the world is full of opportunity, and you've got to be optimistic and positive, and you know, believe in hope, have a strong feeling about the good in people, and then just go grab it. When opportunities, or I tell people all the time, when opportunities open up, when somebody opens the door for you, walk through. Don't sit and say, I'm not so sure, I don't think I can make it, I don't think it's going to be worthwhile. You never know what's on the other side of that door. Go for it. If it doesn't work out, it will lead you to other doors. You will learn from it. So, as I said, the world is just full of wonderful, positive opportunities. And what we need right now more than ever, in the world that we live in today, is a sense of continuous optimism, promotion of hope and decency and integrity, building trust. We go forward as a community together. We work together. We help one another. We are all interdependent. COVID has demonstrated that more than anything in the last 12 months, that we're all so interdependent. But be positive. You know what I say, attitude is a small thing that makes a huge difference, but positive attitude makes a huge, huge difference. And if you trip up, as I said, and it doesn't work out, and we all make mistakes every day. I make mistakes every day. I fail on some things every week. But if you're not failing, you're not moving forward. You learn from those failures, and then you move forward. So, when I meet with all those new employees every Monday, I do it by Zoom now because of COVID, but within a couple of months, we'll be back doing it in person again. And I just love watching people stopping their careers and thinking and trying to inspire them to think about the possibilities that exist that are ahead of you. Everybody has enormous potential. You just got to recognize it and begin to adapt, be resilient, and be continuously tenacious. And one other thing, I make books available to people all the time. You've got to continue to learn, continue to read, continue to educate yourself. Because the more you understand and expand your horizons, broaden your perspective about the possibilities that are out there, it just opens up so many doors. So read, learn, educate, be positive, and the future is great.
Michael Dowling, I want to ask you about the timing of your most recent book, and it is called Leading Through a Pandemic. It came at a time when COVID and when the pandemic was, in particularly in the United States, nothing but a political football. You wouldn't know if you could even believe the Lord's Prayer for any of them, as we might say at home. And was that part of the motivation for you to say, I can't wait for this to be over. I do want to get the story out. I want to get it out now. Innovation, humanity, you know, and what did we learn, or what were we learning, or were we in a very confusing, state, you know, which you were addressing in your book, Leading Through a Pandemic?
Well, what happened, I didn't start out at the very beginning planning a book at all. As the pandemic hit us at the beginning, we were at the real epicenter here in New York at the beginning. So what I was doing every weekend, I would sit down and make notes to myself about the experience that we had the previous week, what we were learning, and the types of things that we really had to do differently and better. And so week after week, I would jot down that information. And then somebody actually mentioned to me, you know, given the fact that we're going through an experience that hardly anybody, nobody else in our in generation has ever gone through before, that there was a need for somebody to put a book together on this. And I had already had all of this material. So I sat at home one weekend, and I drafted a number of pages about lessons learned from our experience over the first couple of months. And then I worked with this guy, Charlie Kenny, who works for me, and we decided to put the book together. And it came out, in the summer, a couple of months after COVID began. And what it basically talks about are the lessons that we learned at Northwell, being at the epicenter. And I've outlined the things that we've got to be thinking about as we go forward, what the future should look like, and what we need to get prepared for, because these kinds of things will happen again. And it was also meant to be instructive for people around the country who at that time had not yet got a lot of COVID but were about to begin to get it. So I sent that book to a lot of people around the country saying, these are the lessons we learned here in New York. This is what we had to do. This is how we adapted. You might find this instructive as you have to deal with COVID in your environment over the next number of months. And it has got quite a lot of attention. And
That's great. Yeah. It is.
Yeah.
You know, also, I would like to, to mention to our listeners that normally somebody in your position running a massive healthcare system, largest east of the Mississippi, and indeed way up in terms of the entire United States, that, you're asked, or perhaps nobody asks you, but you choose to go outside the realm of what you'd normally expect from a hospital healthcare system. And you started also, and people listened when you said you have to get bloody guns off the street. That is something that falls under, a very healthy human output, or lessons, again, that we don't expect to hear from you. Leave that to somebody else.
Well, United States has many unique, distinctive features. And fortunately, so many are positive. But we also are very distinctive because of the violence resulting from guns. Every year, we have about 40,000. Deaths resulting from gunshot wounds. We have, guns are a major, major part of domestic violence. It is, in my view, it is a health issue. When you're in the healthcare business like I am, and you see in the operating rooms, in the emergency rooms, you see the results of gun violence. You see the physical damage it does, the mental health damage it does, the social damage it does. And if we're concerned about health overall, we have to understand and treat gun violence as a public health issue. Now, I have not been talking about the Second Amendment. I have not been making the argument that people should not have guns. I'm making the argument that we should make sure that only those who legitimately should have guns can get them, and that for those people with guns, we got to be promoting it with safety as we possibly can. But it is a major, major issue. And even during COVID over the past 12 months, there has been such an acceleration of people buying guns. So I have been very, very public about this. I've been doing a lot of work with a lot of people around the country. I have been working very closely with Congresswoman Giffords, if you remember, who was shot a couple of years back. I did a program with her actually this week. And a lot of the large businesses, a lot of Fortune 500 companies are getting on board dealing with this. So we have a crisis in our hands here, and it is a health issue. And if we treat it as a health issue, I think we can get a lot more people concerned about it. I have been very public on it, just like I have been about the issue around veterans. I've been pretty public about the issue around immigration. And I do think when you're a leader in an organization, any kind of leader in any organization, that you do have a responsibility and an obligation to speak publicly about those things that impact negatively on the community around us. We do have a responsibility to help our communities improve and get better. It's just not only inside our organizations where we have a responsibility. I think we have a responsibility more globally and community-wide. And if we all can work together on things like this, such as gun violence, we can make the world a better place. At the end of the day, that's the purpose of leadership, is to make the world a better place. It takes some courage sometimes. Some people are nervous to talk about issues like that. But I believe, as somebody asked me the other day about being courageous to take on issues like that, my answer was, well, courage is a core ingredient of leadership. If you want to be a leader, you have to have some courage. If you have no courage, therefore, I would question whether you're a leader or not. So, yes, Adrian, I have been out there very publicly on this, and I will continue. But it's actually getting an awful lot of traction, the treatment of gun violence as a public health issue.
Let me, I want to ask you about, in particular, the immigrant. We have listened now for, decades, without getting into the political aspect of it, immigrant has become a dirty word. The best thing you can do, don't even bring it up. Duck it altogether. And here's Dowling again to the forefront in using your own story as an example of what, immigrants, what their contribution is, rather than, what the hell, they're coming in here and they're taking our jobs and boom, boom, boom. What is that?
Well, for the people who claim and, look at immigrant as a dirty word, I would say to them, they have absolutely no understanding of history. They have no understanding of their own history. It demonstrates an extraordinary ignorance, quite frankly, because everybody is an immigrant or a descendant of an immigrant. New York City is the result of immigrants. This is why, the famous book that was written on New York City called The City of Dreams. Yeah. People came here from all over the world with dreams about making a better life for them and their families. And, the United States is the result of immigrants from all over the world coming together to make this country what it is today. And it's still continuing that way. So, we have to be very, very positive about the contribution of immigrants, Irish immigrants, Italian immigrants, Jewish immigrants, Indian immigrants, etc. That's what makes the United States unique. That's what makes us special. And every immigrant group that has come here, as you know, Adrian, have always been relatively mistreated by the group that was here before. That's the history of the United States. The Irish didn't treat the Italians that well. The English didn't treat the Irish that well when they came here. But over time, people came together. They coalesced. They still retained the culture from the countries which they came. But then they created a larger culture called the American culture. And this is, we got St. Patrick's Day coming up. And what is St. Patrick's Day? It's a celebration of Irish culture, but it's also a celebration of immigration. And you will have people walking up Fifth Avenue. We're not going to be doing it this year, but every year prior to last year, people from every part of the world walking up Fifth Avenue in celebration of immigration in the American way. We are the result of the contribution of immigrants. That's what America is. That's its uniqueness. That's its distinctive nature. And for those that wallow in ignorance, I would say, please go home, take out a book, read a little bit about your own predecessor's history, read a little bit about the history of the United States. I understand, and you know, you can get overly political on this. I understand that there is some element of racism in some of the current issues that people talk about. You know, they want people from certain parts of the world, they don't want people from other parts of the world. But I think America is the result of people from every part of the world. That's what makes us so unique.
Michael Dowling, first of all, we won't even, if we were to list all the awards you've gotten on both sides of the Atlantic, would be here for the day and probably through St. Patrick's Day. But there are a couple, you know, the Presidential Award from your native Ireland, just about every award known to mankind was there. And yet, when you were Grand Marshal of the St. Patrick's Day Parade a few years back, you told us all that of all the awards that one could get for you leading the St. Patrick's Day Parade, having your family from Ireland, that this was something that you didn't need to top that one.
That was, you know, absolutely extraordinary. And, you know, when you look back at the people that have led the parade up the Fifth Avenue over the years, and you consider yourself one of those individuals and be privileged to be part of that group, it is absolutely extraordinary. You know, and I recall that when I was asked and told that I was selected, I was absolutely flabbergasted. And in walking up Fifth Avenue on that day, it was a pretty cold day, if I remember.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was saying to myself, this is a long way from Knockaderry. And I remember my mother saying to me, don't ever let your circumstance, however bad it is, preclude you from doing something positive in the future. You should never curtail your potential. And she was right.
She was right.
I mean, I was back in the young kid in Knockaderry. I mean, I knew I was going to leave that place at one point. It's still home to me, though. I still go back. I still love the place. But for me to take advantage of this, the opportunities I thought I could take advantage of, I knew I had to leave. But walking up Fifth Avenue that day, I'm thinking, you know, everything is possible. This is a reflection of America. This is the reflection of such a great place this is, despite its imperfections, despite some of the criticisms of it. There is nothing perfect, but it for me to be able to do this is a reflection of what it allows you to do. I had to pinch myself that day walking up Fifth Avenue. And my family, being there at the same time from Knockaderry walking up, they never even thought that they would ever experience walking in any parade like this. Yet they were walking up behind me as the Grand Marshal. It was exhilarating. I was unbelievably privileged. It was unbelievably humbling. But in many ways, if it's not about me, that day, it's a reflection of America.
Yeah.
The opportunity it has given so many of us, and the opportunity that's given so many people from every part of the world to come here, expose their talents, contribute to the development of what America is and what it again can become and will become again, and what it has been. It was a day that I will never, ever, ever forget. And it does surpass on pretty much everything else that I've ever received. But the other thing, Adrian, to be clear, we should never, we get a lot of awards when you're in these positions, but I mean, you got to keep your feet on the ground. You got to stay humble. You still got to get up tomorrow morning and try to, you know, do better than you did the day before. You never let these awards get to your head. You never let your head to swell up and think, oh my God, I am so special. Look what is happening to me.
Yeah.
No, we contribute. You know, there is still, no matter how much you do today or how much you did yesterday, you can always do better tomorrow. And so everybody should always be figuring out, how do I improve over today by doing something greater tomorrow?
You know, on that, I sincerely want to thank you, and I know our listeners will appreciate you're coming on, you're telling your story, leading through the pandemic. And by the way, friends, it's a Simon & Schuster printer, available on Amazon just about everywhere else. But it is the story of humanity, innovation, and again, the lessons learned. You don't read much about Mike Dowling in this book, but what you do get across is, here is somebody that says, again, exactly, I think, what you personify. And that is, yes, we learn it. We are learning. We're learning how to do it. It's not a, here I am, and, you know, I've gotten this one sorted out. It's directed to a great number of people, again, who needed to know, well, you know, with all of the political conflicts that are going on, hey, we took the bull by the horns, but we're only here yet. We're going to stick with you. This is not just a capsule of, you know, what has happened, and Graham McCree, as say at home, saying, isn't it awful? This is saying, you have to take it. You have to accept it. You don't have to hide. You have to do something.
Yeah, absolutely, but correct, Adrian. I mean, every day we try to transform ourselves to continually improve. And the book, there's not a lot about me in the book, because quite frankly, it was about the staff who did the work. And the book is a celebration of the great work that my people did. That's what it's all about. They jumped in and they took on something that back at the beginning, nobody knew much about the virus. It was this invisible thing that we didn't know a lot about, and we tackled it. And you get hit with bad circumstances continuously, and it's how you react to them that defines your character. So problems do strike, and then you've got to adapt and deal with them and do the best you possibly can. If it works, it works. If it works partly, that's fine. And then you keep moving on. Do your best. Give it your best effort. Do it with sincerity and with a sense of decency. Treat people well. And understand that we're all part of a community, a diverse community, especially here in the United States, very diverse community. And when we can help each other get better and improve, then the whole community gets better and improves.
I want to thank you. You've been great to take the time and also to make the presentation to let people feel better, with a lot of hope. Many thanks.
Thank you, Adrian. I appreciate it. And happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody. Let's celebrate, be hopeful. Next year, 2022, we'll be walking up Fifth Avenue.
Thank you. Thank you. Mike Dowling. Okay, friends, for spending an hour with us. An amazing, extraordinary man, but I don't have to tell you anything about that. It oozes from him. Every single time that he has an opportunity, Dowling is indeed somebody to be listened to. The book, Leading Through a Pandemic, Michael Dowling.